Thank you. So very happy to be here after some time. And I have to say, I'm going to give you a lot of caveats about the format of the talk. This is not particularly the talk that I would give if I'm invited to talk about my work. I think this talk, it was organized, keeping in mind that to create synergies, right? So Mitchell at the University of Waterloo and I have been having some exchanges about what kind of things we can do as a community, okay, to solve problems that are interested, and I'm interested in nuclear astrophysics, and I hope he brought a lot of guys from the University of Waterloo, and I was thinking of taking attendance and so on. So my first caveat is that this talk is structured in a way that is more in a colloquial style, and that means it has the very basics, because I was hoping that to just start with some describing some of the jargon that we use in astrophysics. And from the other hand, there are many problems in nuclear physics that are relevant for astrophysics, so obviously I'm not going to cover everything, it's impossible, but I definitely will touch on different topics. No, I'm not an expert on all of them, but definitely I want to give an overview of what kind of things we can work together. I'm going to show work that is not totally mine, or work that I have done in the past, so I'm a little bit rusty about it, but I'm willing to get all oily and work again on that. Okay, with all those caveats, just feel free to interrupt me anytime, and we can have a discussion. Okay, so for the condensed matter crowd, let me introduce what is this idea about multi-messengers, right? So the way I thought that to introduce this, I'm pretty sure the way that many of you have already given talks about this, is talking about what happened last year in August 17. Okay, so that was the first time that we were able to detect gravitational waves. Now, it was like a triumph of the community, because it was not only about gravitational waves, but things that we were already predicted over decades, and it was just this confirmation. So what is this multi-messenger idea? The idea is that we have a signal of gravitational waves. This is this line that you want to see here, and I'm sorry about my very descriptive vocabulary. And then you have, this is in gravitational waves, then there was another correlated signal in gamma ray bursts. In gamma rays, here are the detectors. The resolution of this plot is not excellent, but I'm reading it for you. Then we have electromagnetic waves in many bands. Some of the ones that I'm showing here are in infrared, optical, and radio, and this is just images from telescopes, different telescopes around the world that recorded coincidence or correlations with this first gravitational wave signal. So there are, we are very fortunate to have nowadays capabilities that allows us to record all the signals and figure out where the signal is coming from and what it relates to. So now we learn from understanding the signals, the different signals, that this event was coming from the merger of two neutron stars. At least this is the best model we have so far. There could be discrepancies between interpretations between different groups. So far, we think that it was a merger of two neutron stars, and that this encounter triggered gravitational waves and all these different kind of electromagnetic signals. So that's what we call multi-messenger, our ability to measure or detect different signals and correlated, and from that, we want to have an understanding of what the process, astrophysical process, are behind. Understanding all these signals is related to several of the long-standing problems in nuclear physics. One of them is the formation of new elements, and particularly heavy elements. So I'm showing you here the abundances of elements as a function of the mass number understood as the number of protons and neutrons in a nucleus. And you can see the abundance, meaning the relative amount of one element with respect here to this nucleus. And therefore, you can see that this spans several orders of magnitude. Okay, so it goes from almost 10 to the 12 to 10 to the minus 2 here. And this is what it was deduced from observation. So we look at the stars, we see some spectrum, and from the spectra, we can get to know how much is of these elements, okay? So you notice that there is this region here where the abundance is very low. This is called the neutron-rich elements. There in this region, there are many more neutrons than protons inside the nucleus, and we still don't understand how this came about, how this happened, right? So that's one of the biggest mysteries in nuclear astrophysics, to understand what is the origin of these elements. Now, this also, understanding this signal is related to other problems, and are, for example, what is the nature of some stellar explosions, for example, supernova and gamma ray bursts. So we know they happen, we just don't understand exactly how the amount of energy is released. We don't understand where the source is completely, and it's correlated also to the way of how nuclear reactions happen inside stars that are getting fed at the all at the end of their life. That takes me to the next point, and also a fundamental point in nuclear physics is understanding the nature, the structure of matter at high densities. Okay, so these high densities are enormous, are millions, billion times the density of the most dense elements you can think of. For example, if you think that lead is dense, well, these stars are a billion times denser. And they, the matter at that densities tell us a lot about what happened in a nucleus. So we can make a correlation between what happened in experiments on Earth or how the nucleus behaves with the behavior of these stars. So they are called neutron stars because they have more neutrons than protons. They are mainly made of neutrons as a whole, as a macroscopic system. And therefore, that's why it's the analogy with a nucleus in the lab. So just to give a context for the condensed matter people, neutron stars occur at the very end of a gigantic star that explodes. So the normal life of a star is a compensation between the gravitational force, the star wants to collapse under its own gravity, and then it doesn't for the vast majority of its lifetime because there are thermonuclear reactions that keep a pressure outwards, and therefore there is a balance between the two effects. But as nuclear reactions happen, then one material is, one nucleus is becoming other to other, and that pressure outward is gone. Then when the nuclear fuel is over, then the star doesn't have any other option than to collapse under their own weight. While that is happening, as the matter is getting very, very much compressed under its own gravity, then neutrons and protons start touching each other pretty much, and then there are chances that electrons are captured by neutrons and positrons by neutrons and electrons by positrons, and therefore there is what we call leptonization, and that means that the weak reactions take place. Then there are a lot of neutrinos, which are elemental particles, are produced, providing a little bit of pressure against that, that collapse, and making the star to collapse, and that's what we call a supernova. So there is a gigantic amount of binding energy from gravity that is coming into place here and is transforming different signals, including neutrinos. Okay, so that's my rough cartoon about how neutron stars are born. Neutron stars are the residuals of a collapse of a gigantic star, and the star has to be at least 8 times heavier than the sun. Okay, okay, so that means that these objects are very, very dense, are so dense that we think that what we're doing is not only that we think we have observational evidence that the stars have a radius of about 12 kilometers, and this, to put things in perspective, I live in Guelph, so it's going from Guelph to the 401, more or less, and then put all the mass of the sun in that radius. So it's highly dense matter. I put here some scale so you can compare what is the density of these neutron stars compared to the density of the nucleus and the density of lead. Okay, so I just talking about going back to the multi-messenger idea. I just told you, I introduced you what are multi-messenger signals. Then I told you how they're connected to long-standing problems in nuclear astrophysics. And then I'm going to try to explain this cartoon that is done by Brian Metzer. And I think it's something that we have predicted for decades. It's just this understanding is better now with the observation last year. And therefore, I thought this is a good reference if you want to take a look. But it's not that this was the first reference about how things happen, but it's a very good one. OK? So this is how we understand this. Two neutron stars find each other, okay, at some point. Then they start feeling each other gravitational field. Because they are so dense, they change the space-time around it that generates some gravitational waves, okay? And even before they really encounter each other in terms of the density becoming just one, so there are some gravitational waves already emitted here. Then as the star collapses, there's a matter, a neutron star matter is decompressed, okay? So now it's not quite a part of one star or the other, it's decompressed. This decompression makes neutrons and protons to fuse again, and they can form new elements, okay? So this is what we have here as a process, the first process of nucleosynthesis that can happen in a neutron star, okay, by merging neutron stars. Then this object can merge into one single body, and this can lead to a gigantic neutron star, which we call a hypermassive neutron star, and then that will eventually collapse to a black hole. During that time, it could be a disk of matter rotating about this hypermassive neutron star or black hole. During this time, matter has been heated up, the gravitational energy has increased the temperature of this disk. Therefore, there are a lot of neutrinos produced here. These neutrinos can push matter out of it in what we call neutrino winds, okay? And these winds are out and also make react with neutrons and protons. And then these neutrons and protons fuse again. So there is another possibility here for nucleosynthesis and a different kind of nucleosynthesis, perhaps from this one. At the end of the day, there are different kinds of atomic nuclei formed here in the long distance. This process also can, neutrinos, for example, can come and interact with matter with electrons over here. The electrons can annihilate each other and produce gamma ray bursts. This radioactive nuclei can decay, and the decay will heat up the interstellar medium, and we will see this as what we call a kilonova. That was all these electromagnetic signals that I talked initially about. The details of this coming to be a hypermassive neutron star or a black hole, or what amount of neutrinos is emitted here, or what kind of elements are formed, strongly depends on the interactions between neutrons and protons, which lead to an equation of a state of the whole system. So if we get to understand better the equation of a state of a neutron star, or the merger, because this will be a higher temperatures, then we have better chances to understand the gravitational wave signal and to understand the other signals that are being emitted. Okay, so let's take a look at what a neutron star is inside, okay? So I have a cartoon here that you may have seen before, and I'm gonna try to walk you through it, okay? For the people that are no experts on it. So we think that the neutron star in the outer regions, okay, will be formed, will have some ions and a sea of electrons, okay? So the electrons are relativistic, are degenerate, and the ions, the nuclei are just ionized, so they are apart from these electrons. That's in the outer crust. as you go deeper in density, then there's going to be some of these nuclei still are ionized, okay? But then as the density increases, it's favorable for some nucleides or some nucleons to drip out of nuclei. So what you're going to find is a mix of electrons and neutrons and nuclei. And as you go deeper in the crust, you have to understand what is the structure of these nuclei and what is the behavior of these neutrons, because at some point, you're going to find what is called a liquid core of neutrons, where neutrons behave as a superfluid. And then deeper inside in the core, we hypothesize, we theorize that there is going to be a quark-gluon plasma. How thick these layers, different layers are, again, depend on the transition from one state of matter to the other, and that depends on the equation of the state. So since I'm already talking about the structure of a neutron star, I want to give you two examples of observations that are correlated specifically to the crust. And we are interested in the crust for the following reason. The same way if you were an astronaut trying to understand how the Earth behaves and you are far away, the first thing you will see from Earth will be the atmosphere and the crust. You don't really get to know about the interior of the crust. So that's why we're very interested understanding the crust. So there are two observations I want to talk about are about X-ray bursts and gravitational waves from neutron stars. And in the first case, it's neutron stars that are dragging matter from a companion star. So in this cartoon, the neutron star is here at the center, and its strong gravitational field is just pulling matter out from a companion star that, as a regular star, would be mostly made of protons. Okay? Well, protons and neutrons, but mostly just hydrogen or helium. The other case I want to talk about here is a gravitational wave emitted for a neutron star. Okay, so if you happen to have a mountain in a neutron star, we want to understand if this is spinning too fast, then it's going to perturb a space of time around it and it potentially emit gravitational waves. So let me start by the accretion, the neutron star that is accreting matter. So if that is happening, you can think about the neutron star in this cartoon I showed you. The matter is being accreted from the companion in these different layers. So the first thing that the matter that is accreted is going to encounter is a bunch of ions. And then going deeper, ions perhaps in a lattice and neutrons, and then it's buried. But all that, this hot matter that is interacting with this cold neutron matter and cold ions, and therefore is potentially is going to trigger reactions. Some of them are going to be thermonuclear reactions, and some others are going to be picnonuclear reactions, because just depend on how much the pressure of the other layers are making these reactions to happen. So picnonuclear reactions are due to pressure. Now, observations of this system, particularly this system, there are several observations in X-ray bursts, and this is one example. And the red lines show you what is being observed. So after a period of accretion, then this matter is going to trigger X-ray bursts, and these are the observations. The star eventually is going to cool down after this burst. So we want to understand how the star cools down. And when you think about understanding how a star, something cools down, what do you think about thermal conductivity, right? So these authors plot here or compare different ways of understanding the crust. One of them, for example, was assuming a low thermal conductivity, while these other models assume that the crust has a high thermal conductivity. You will agree with me that it's obvious that the crust seem to behave with high thermal conductivity. So that's what we can get from it.
So is this curve ruling out the possibility that this crust is amorphous?
Yes. that the outer crust is amorphous. I cannot say anything else about inside. What this plot is showing me is that if we assume that the outer crust, only the argus, no still anything else that happens inside, is amorphous, that's ruled out because it doesn't match the prediction. Doesn't match the observation. So yes, it's ruling out that the crust is amorphous.
But then you're saying it's a single crystal. How come it's
a single crystal?
Yeah. How come it is a single crystal? I mean, it creates like material from other stuff, and then it still forms a single crystal after.
I didn't say it forms a single crystal. I just say it's not a solid liquid, a solid amorphous liquid, free stuff. So how do we study this and what we can draw that conclusion? So there are models that you can do some analytical work to try to understand this, but what we did was using molecular dynamics. So how do we model that to see if this is, we should roll out or not that the crust is a crystal? So what we do is make a simple model. We take the crust to be just composed of ions. We don't need to think about the electrons right away. We can add that later. And the ions, the electrons are going to just be, will act as a screening term here for the potential between different ions, okay? Now, if you put this into a molecular dynamic simulation, what you can get out of it is just as a semi-classical approach, you're going to get the positions and velocities of every single ion in the crust. You have to assume first what is the composition of that crust. And we can get back to that point in a bit. Point is that you will have then, therefore, densities, density distribution, right? And this density can be just interpreted as, you know, this expression here with Q, it will be the prop you want to understand. In this case, electrons, for example, the momentum of electrons, okay? If that's the kind of thing that you want to help. So after some time of simulation, okay, then you can extract that structure factor here. This is the black line that you see here. And you can see there are peaks, right? And these lines that are here, these two lines, assume that the crystal, that the crust is amorphous, an amorphous phase. So you can see that there is kind of an overlap between, yes, some amorphous material here, but then the peaks here are matched to what you would think of a crystal, either BCC or FCC and so on. With that, you can calculate the thermal conductivity. I have the thermal conductivity here for different cases. I know this is kind of blurry here, but I'm gonna try to tell you that. If you assume that the crust is made only of one kind of crystal, it's not the same as assuming that the only one kind of atom or only one kind of ion is not the same as assuming that it's made of several multi-component atoms or ions. I keep using the one thing. So these little white dots that you probably don't see here much, but I'm trying to point out at them, are oxygen 24. Okay, so it's very neutron-rich oxygen. And although you can see like this at the edges, this kind of reproduces itself, is actually this is just a periodicity of our boundary conditions. Point is that the ions, this the oxygen, tend to be more in one part of the crust than in the other. That means that led us to conclude a part of seeing the crystal phase here, that there are gonna be impurities around this crystal, and that impurities are gonna be actually phase separated. Low set impurities will be in one side of the crust, while higher C are gonna be in another side of the crust. The higher set, deeper in the crust. I hope I respond some of your questions, but I'm here for discussion, not for talking about my results. So I don't mind if I don't go through all my insights. So do you have another concern?
This is a different layer. This is a different layer.
Yes, you can have different domains.
So you're changing depths.
Here we found one single crystal, but we did many simulations of this, and we had different crystals. Is that the question? You can have so different domains. That's the word for that.
So how these impurities, like, I don't know. So you computed this thermal conduction coefficient, but how? So there are other things, right, like absorption. How would you affect those other properties, or I don't know.
There are other things, like other processes, other nuclear processes happening?
No, I'm thinking about what would be the effect of these impurities. Okay, so I guess, sorry, I'm thinking about another amorphous material, sorry. Not neutron star crust, but it's also related to gravitational waves. So
yes, it is.
So I'm thinking about the coating some LIGO neurons. Okay, so people have been saying that it's very different, but it's an amorphous crystal, and people are very interested in the mechanical properties of these things. I don't think people have ever done that. It's a material dynamics study of this material, but it turns out the mechanical property, like for example the Young's modulus, and more importantly the absorption coefficient, it's extremely important for the solenoids of this coating. So I think people have been arguing about what are the source of this absorption and absorption coefficients. People are saying maybe it's because of impurities. Or maybe it's because it's a amorphous crystal, like.
I agree with you, there is no consensus, and part of it is depends where we are observing this. So we think that this is the observation that I showed you before, happened in the outer crust. And what I see is the outer crust will form a crystal to be able to understand this, but there are caveats, and I didn't mention. So the assumption here is that the dragging of matter inside happens at a rate that inside the crust that is equilibrium. So you can think of the composition of matter in a steady state. There are many things happening here. As the matter is being dragged, there are going to be some thermonuclear reactions happening, and then for some sort of nucleosynthesis, what we call the RP process. But that's not the end of it. These RP process are ashes that are going to keep buried inside the crust. To my understanding of the way I would see it, is that we cannot assume that the composition of the crust is going to be the same throughout, because there are some set of nuclear reactions that are happening in the outer crust, another set of nuclear reactions that are happening inside in the inner crust. And that then is going to be more related to the nuclear pasta phase than what I'm talking about. So I haven't reached it. So that I agree there is no consensus about this. Yeah.
I think for neutron star crusts, people are interested. I mean, whether people are interested in this the mechanical response of this shell module. So, like for example, if you buy neutron stars, if they're really close, and then the crust is largely distorted by the tidal field coming from the other neutron star. So once the strain reaches some critical level, it may be behave very differently from a usual crystal or something. So the mechanical response is very different. So it will have this plastic phase or whatever.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to that.
Okay.
But not fully as you're saying, but yeah. But I'm gonna touch on that. So this is I think this is what Juan is talking about. So let's pretend that there is a mountain in the neutron star crust, okay? In the neutron star, which is gonna be seen in the crust, okay? Now here I make this cartoon gigantic. This a mountain, a neutron star cannot hold mountains that large. It's gonna be very small, but still a mountain. So in principle, if there's such thing, then there's gonna be a gravitational wave strain that we're gonna be able to detect here. And it's going to depend on the moment of inertia of the star. And here I'm missing some subject. This is Anyway, and the ellipticity of the star, this is the frequency. The frequency is going to be twice the frequency of rotation of the star, and this is the distance of the neutron star to our detectors. And again, this is all blurry, but the ellipticity can be, at the end of the day, related to the quadrupole mass, okay? And the quadrupole mass of the neutron star is related to the shear model and breaking strain of the neutron star. Okay, so some other works have studied the breaking strain of a neutron star. So to do that, then again, the same Coulomb potential was assumed for the ions, okay? And then they took these molecular dynamic simulations with these many millions of ions at a temperature and densities that will emulate the outer crust of the neutron star. Then they put the star under strain, like assuming, oh, okay, I can show you here. If you take a look here at this upper face and this lower bottom here, you can see that this is maintained still. And there is the layers are moved in different directions in this simulation. And the initial, if you want, the initial volume was made of crystals of ions here in different directions, okay? And then the different colors tell you what kind of crystal was. There is one that is a polycrystal, which I understand has more impurities around. Okay, so after you can put different shear strains that are given here by these numbers that go at 0.05, 0.15 here, and then at some point, what it was found in these simulations, okay, is that the breaking strain will be around 0.1, which is quite large from other estimates, okay, and the ellipticity can be around these numbers. Now, 10 to the minus 5 minus 6 is quite large compared to the upper limits from the several non-parcel searches that have been already set a limit of 10 to the minus 8. Now, that was from some of the pulsars that we know. It's difficult to really find, detect gravitational waves from all neutron stars possible out there. So there are searches, and these numbers can change. Point here is what I think Juan is trying to argue, is that in this simulation, what it was found is that actually the neutron star crust in the crust is not going to just behave like a regular material that we find on Earth. It's not going to be under strain, find a breaking point, and then break at the same time. No, there is a collective behavior that gives the neutron star more like a plastic behavior, and it will allow rearrangement of the ions so there are no voids or no holes of fractures inside the neutron star, because under these pressures, the gigantic pressures for the neutron star, they're gonna get repaired, okay? So I agree, this is what the simulation sees. This is hopeful in terms that maybe we can measure at some point this. I'm talking here only about the outer crust, okay? So there is some repairing mechanism of the outer crust. And although we see that there could be some crystals, crystal-like behavior, the most likely behavior is a polycrystal itself. And there's some collective behavior due to the long-range character of the Coulomb force.
Do you think these impurities will change that?
Excuse me?
So if you have impurities,
yes. Yes, indeed. That's what it's trying to say. That impurities here are important. Yes. So I talk about the outer crust, and then I want to go back to the inner crust. Okay. I want to. Obviously, I told you that there is a phase when there are only ions and electrons, and then a phase where there are liquid neutrons, okay, or neutrons behaving like a gas. So there must be a point where there is a transition between one phase and the other. And this is where we understand the crust then. Just showing this cartoon that at lower densities, we think that nuclei are formed, okay, and then as the density are higher, then the nuclei start being more and more neutron rich. At some point, under higher densities, the nuclei start touching each other, and there becomes a point where it's energetically favorable for the nuclei to form new phases, where you can see a strain of nuclear matter, like we call spaghetti, and spaghetti kind of form, or it could be a sheet like a lasagna. And then if you go deeper in the density, then you will see uniform neutron matter, perhaps with some holes, and that will be the switches phase. And that's what we call the nuclear past. So why does the nuclear past come about? Well, it had been a lot of works already that long work, long time ago, that predicted that this behavior will occur, and it's a phenomenon of frustration. So essentially what is happening is that as the density increases, the ions not only see each other through the Coulomb force. Coulomb, I just realized that got cut here. Well, I meant Coulomb, which, you know, if you think about the ions being just, the charge will be determined by the protons, then it's going to be repulsive. But as the density increases, then the ions are closer to each other, and then this is the limit when the nuclear forces come to play. So therefore, there is an ambiguity for the ions. They don't know what to do. Should I be repulsive to this other ion that is over here, or should be attracted to this one? So because of that, there is this phenomenon. Then the matter takes on a different phase. Mitchell is an expert on frustration. I guess that the part of talking about this is to see if we end up finding an interesting overlap. So there are different, as I mentioned, it was found analytically a while ago. And since then, there have been different kind of simulations, molecular dynamic simulations, quantum molecular dynamic simulations, hard rock simulations, and so on, that are reassuring us. And these are the old works on this, but after that, an avalanche of different works have come to discuss what is happening about this. So I'm showing you just results of simulations for the nuclear pasta for molecular dynamics. So notice the difference here in the potential. Before I showed you a Coulomb potential, now we have here a very different potential. Notice that there are different parts of the potential. One is neutron-proton, neutron-neutron, proton-proton, because the character of the nuclear force is such that can distinguish between one or the other, we have to add the Coulomb potential to the protons. And this that I'm showing you here has some coefficients that are chosen to reproduce nuclear matter properties that have been studied analytically, and some binding energy of nuclei that we know on Earth. Believe it or not, this is a very simple potential. So even though it reproduces some observables from nuclei, the nuclear force is one of the major mysteries for nuclear physics. So we don't have an answer. But we have to deal with it somehow. And the problem is the following. The nuclear force is such that if you have two neutrons interacting, or trying to measure the cross-section of a neutron or a proton, is very different from what you will have inside a nucleus, and it's very different if you have a million of them around. So it's not only about trying to find what is the nuclear force, but it's also to solve the many-body problem of nuclear force. Okay, so there is no the right nuclear force that we can give or put our hands in the fire for that expression. And it's a current subject of research, okay? So this one is a very simple form that describes more or less what is happening. And as you can see, oh boy, I didn't realize that this doesn't have density, but you can think of this as increasing density in this direction. So you can see that at low densities, they are like gnocchi. In reality, you can think of this as just a nuclei. Okay? Because this is solved in neutron degrees, in nucleon degrees of freedom. And then as you increase, then these gnocchi rearrange themselves to form these spaghetti-like shapes. And then if you increase more in density, then is when the voids show up. So this will at some point be all uniform matter with the inverse of this other phase. So gnocchi and anti-gnocchi. Okay.
So what are the length scales between these structures?
oh, I don't know what is the length scale between this and this, but I can tell you that the nucleus here, each nucleus is of the order of Fermis, a few tens of Fermis. And what I can tell you that what it has been speculated about these FASTA phases, see that this is just a volume, but it's a simulation volume. It could be of the order of centimeters, okay? It could be as large that they become macroscopic, okay? Now, it's not shown here because this is just a simulation volume. It doesn't represent what could be happening really in the neutron star at the macroscopic level. But it shows us how they can rearrange themselves to become a different phase. More questions? Because I'm going to change a little bit the topic. Okay.
So the neutron superfluid we're talking about?
Excuse me?
The neutron superfluid phase.
No, this is a...
No. In the previous slide, you were showing that there's a region that might be a superfluid phase.
Yes, that will happen after this part, right? So if you want to think about the outer neutron star crust will be at this region, and then the pasta phase will be happening in the intersection between the liquid phase of the neutrons and the outer crust. And it's just natural to think about that.
Yes. My question is, what's known about that phase?
The neutron matter?
The neutron superfluid phase.
Oh, it is. It is.
Do you mean superfluid, or do you actually mean supernatural?
Both. So there is a part of the neutron star, a liquid part that is going to be superfluid because of the neutrons, but there are some protons there. So we want to think that there are almost no protons, and it's true given the large amount of neutrons that are in the crust or in the neutron star, but there are some little amount of protons that become superconductors. So you can have both phenomena at the same time. Now, the superfluidity of the neutron star has been studied. There are many different approaches because we think there are some glitches, like a change in the spinning of the star that can be understood by thinking of vortices of the superfluid being formed in the neutron star. Now, I'm not an expert on it, but there are observables that can be related to that. And that is, it's a hot topic in neutron star physics. No more questions?
So you have all these interesting phases as you change the density of your crust. Like, is there any way to probe this?
I'm going there. So one of the ways will be the I don't want to argue. Let me talk about my neutrino stuff that I feel comfortable with. I cannot talk about other observables. I feel more confident about it. So I can discuss ideas off the record. Okay, so neutrino observables. So what I'm trying to say here is the following. If you think that the supernova is leading to a neutron star, there's going to be a phase where there is a proton-neutron star that is already, this matter is maybe already having these phases. And during that time, a lot of neutrinos are being produced. And we want to understand how these neutrinos are emitted for that matter, right? So the high densities and temperatures produce the neutrinos, but the density is so high that the neutrinos will find different scattering points, and they're going to scatter from neutrons and protons that are highly dense. And we want to understand that, okay? So it is important because the vast majority of energy in supernova mergers and these are from black holes are released by neutrinos. On top of that, neutrinos are important to understand nucleosynthesis, meaning the origin of the elements, and slightly variations in the amount of neutrinos being captured by neutrons or protons are gonna change what we call the seed nuclei for nucleosynthesis, okay? So I think there could be a way of relating the pasta behavior to possible nucleosynthesis. So, but this is a speculation that hasn't been, I haven't seen a work that really shows me that, okay? So, but that's one the thing. But what I'm trying to tell you, I think I'm going to show you is that observables about neutrinos tell me about the past phase. Okay? So then here is exactly, that's what I wanted to say. I have two plots here, one that that is from the pasta phase, you want to understand as the inner crust, and this as the outer crust when this only made the matter is formed by ice, okay? So let me talk about this one first. You see here the densities and temperatures kind of emulate what would be a proto-neutron star, okay? And then you can see several lines here. The red line shows you the cross-section, or the neutrino mean free path, which is correlated to the cross-section, okay? And for neutrinos. So neutrinos here can be seen as a probe, okay? So let's say a typical neutrino energy could be around 15 MeV, and then you can observe that you can have orders of magnitude between two things. Consider that the ions don't know about the presence of each other, which is what I call here free, or the ions interacting by the Coulomb force, and therefore they will increase the neutrino mean free path. Now, the difference between the black and green line is just considering all the ions being of the same species, and the black line is considered to be of different species. So you can see here that it will be something that tells us about how the neutrinos are interacting with this crystal, if you want. Now you can do the same, run a simulation for the nuclear pasta in nucleons degrees of freedom, and then you can see that, again, there is a difference. Here, this line, is not a simulation. These are results that when you think about no nuclear pasta phase, okay? And here, there are results if you think about nuclear pasta phase, okay? So there is a drop in the neutrino mean free path due to the correlations between this new phase, okay? So the way that this could change our understanding of explosion, for example, is that if the neutrinos have more time to scatter from one place to another, then they have more chances to be emitted, and you will see more neutrinos being emitted. But if they cannot go farther distance, then they're going to be trapped for some period of time, and therefore they're going to offer one pressure to counteract the collapse. So you can try to change the physics inside, if you're running a simulation, a physics inside your simulation in terms of this neutrino scattering, and see how long it takes for the star to collapse to a black hole or no change or form the neutron star or the luminosities of neutrinos. So you could see some observable in that regard. So how, I'm going to elaborate a little bit more about neutrinos. Obviously, I don't have enough time to show you the rest of my material, but I'm okay. It was about having a discussion with you guys. Let me just make a cartoon here of how we calculate observables for neutrinos being emitted from very dense objects. So in very easy way to think about it is that when neutrinos, when matter is these energies, when matter is hot, is dissociated, meaning there are neutrons and protons, there is no and electrons, there are no ions still formed. And then the neutrinos are generated and are scattered through these different scattering points, and they react with this scattering point in these different ways. One of them is that they're going to be absorbed, fully absorbed, and then they're going to change a proton for a neutron, okay? And therefore, you can understand how in this dense environment, if this reaction is dominant, then matter is going to be neutronized. Or there are scatterings that don't change the flavor. So all neutrinos will equally go under these reactions. Now, the last point of a scattering forms what we call in supernova the neutrino sphere, and I call it in any other kind of geometry the neutrino surface. So let me show you some results of some work that we did with Lewis here about the scattering of mergers, so neutrino scattering in neutron star mergers. How can I make this understandable in a short period of time? So one of the points that I brought up to you is that we don't understand the nuclear force, right? The nuclear force, whatever we decide is, defines an equation of a state, okay? How the thermodynamic variables are related to each other. So there are different models for the nuclear force that you can put in a statistical model and then predict what is the for a given mass, what is the radius of the star will have. So the microscopic behavior will determine what is the macroscopic radius of a star. For a neutron star, for example, if we decide to have 1.335 solar masses around here, under these different nuclear interactions or equations of state, we will predict a short radius 12, or for example, in this other case, 15, about 15. So these three different cases, we call it a soft equation of state and a stiff equation of state, and this will be a kind of medium. And just because what it means is that you can stuff more matter in a smaller volume, which will be this case, that's why it's soft, you can stuff it more. Or stiff will reproduce a larger radius because you cannot compress matter that much. So let's take those cases with these three different equations of state and try to study what is the neutrino surface. So I just plotting here the two limiting cases for the soft equation of state and for the stiff equation of state. The masses of the two neutron stars are initially the same, okay? And you can see that the soft equation of state produces neutrinos here is temperature that are hotter, okay, overall hotter compared to a stiff equation of state, okay? What we do with these neutrinos is that you can calculate what is the energy at infinity, and having a detector here on Earth, we have such capabilities and say, okay, this there is a difference between the two equations of state and I can see it in neutrinos, okay? So this is the same thing seen as above, from above, and you can say do this for any flavor you want, given your simulation. And of course, this is gonna be related to some gravitational waveform, okay? So the there are experts here about gravity, so I feel a little bit embarrassed to go and explain things for you guys, but just for the condensed matter people, I can tell you that you can see clear differences between the gravitational waveforms if the equation of state is soft or is the stiff type. Okay, so what is happening here and how we correlate these two neutrinos is in the following way. If you have two neutron stars that are stiff, the radii are larger, and therefore the encounter with each other happens earlier on time. So the gravitational waves are gonna start first for the red line. The whole range is not here, just trust me on that. You're gonna start seeing gravitational waves earlier, okay? But compared to a soft equation of state, the radii are smaller, and then the merger happened deeper in the gravitational potential, therefore there is more energy to be converted into neutrinos. Okay, so that means also more energy to spare in gravitational waves. So one could do correlations of the two things and try to figure out what happened. What I did here, or what we did here better, is just to calculate what is the energy of the neutrinos, ignore the parentheses. The parentheses were, it's just to compare what happened if we ignore or no gravitational, gravity, general relativistic effects, okay? And then how we will see these neutrinos on Earth with current capabilities. So we have neutrinos in Super K in Japan, okay? And we assume that this merger happened at 10 kiloparsec. That's like halfway from here to the Milky Way, okay? Crossing the Milky Way. And then you can see that for a stiff equation of state, you will have neutrinos around 18 MeV, and compared with a soft equation of state, there is a difference that you can notice in only in neutrinos, okay? So we are able to resolve these kind of differences in Super K. These are four different times, so I don't want to distract you. I want to get back to these luminosities. You are gonna see more luminous signal if you have a soft equation, let's say. And this is the number of neutrinos per millisecond, okay? And you will see that you will have about 100 neutrinos compared to a few 20 neutrinos in a stiff equation of K. Here is just a comparison with supernova. So you will see that you won't be mistaking supernova neutrinos from mergers. The luminosities are larger here. Again, the range of energies are different. the signal in this case can last for 10 seconds, while the signal here is of the order of milliseconds. So conclusion is, if you were happen to have one of these mergers in the galaxy, and we just have a detector that say neutrino, 20 MeV, then you know that this event is not coming from a supernova, it's coming from a neutron star merger or accretion disk around a black hole.
So
okay?
For this thing, for the numbers in the table, what's the distance?
The distance is 10 kiloparsec.
For bioneutron star mergers as well?
It was honest. What if it happens? Okay, yes, I don't expect that there are going to be a merger soon happen in the galaxy, if that is where you're going. But 10 kiloparsec is just not the whole distance of the galaxy, but an estimate to the center of the galaxy. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I guess if you use the distance of the last event, then you can see that.
So you want to know how far it goes. Yeah, OK, I can do that.
But before you go from that slide, I want to understand the numbers in your table.
I'll get back to you, Juan.
R mu, what is exactly that number? That's the rate at the Earth at 10 kiloparsecs.
That's the rate at super K.
At super K,
how many neutrinos you will have per millisecond? If you change the detector, as is planned, for example, we have a prospect for a liquid argon detector dune, then you will have many more rates, many more counts per millisecond, and you will have different counts, for example, at the Snow Lab, which also have capabilities to detect this. So even though this is, given the merger rate is not large, okay, it's still, if one of these events happens, then we could go and see farther in a, and I think that's where you want to ask how far we could see.
But that's a present detector.
This is a present detector. I'm coming back to Juan. Okay, so we will get one count with super K, and we could see it if we take into account only one count. How far we will see? We will see up to Andromeda, okay, if we have hyper K. And with the current capabilities, we will, in super K, see the Milky Way and satellite galaxies. Okay, now, how many of these mergers happen? I can get an estimate of that too. That, I don't have it right now, but yeah.
It's probably very unlikely to have a bioneutron star merger within one.
In one of this. Yes. If we waited for a couple of centuries, certainly. So what I don't have results here, but what I've been trying to propose is let's study the diffuse background of this event, because there are neutrinos right now permeating our space. And I want to know what is the source, right? And since there are differences in energies, in energy range and luminosity, maybe we can get to see farther. My time is up. I wanted to talk about nucleosynthesis. I'm going to leave the nucleosynthesis plot there. Oh, I should not be rude whatsoever. I'm not going to give you even conclusions. I'm going to acknowledge my collaborators through the years. Obviously, there are other people that I have worked with and I'm not here, so they will be okay, I think. And I'm happy to have more discussion with you guys. Thank you.
Questions? Yeah, I have a question. At the beginning of your talk, you showed this abundance of elements. Maybe you can show it back.
Absolutely. Actually, you can see it here. The stars are the elements that have been observed in the solar system. We think there are reasons to imagine that the solar system abundances are representative of a large...
Let me ask a question.
Yes.
So when you were showing this abundance, I think the vertical axis was solar abundance, and then we have the eight number. And then for platinum and above and beyond, we don't understand this. I don't know what that means, we don't understand it.
Yeah.
Understanding it with respect to what it is.
We cannot reproduce it. If you see the red lines here, we can do things, we can match curves like the. These are theoretical calculations. There is no group whatsoever that can tell you exactly, oh, I got the abundances of gold, and I know what it happens.
Okay. And if you could perhaps show the slide there at the beginning, it's way back. But,
getting there? There you go.
That one. Okay, so this is, what is this plot? It's an observation average over different. Where does this graph come from?
So the plot is abundances, meaning how much of this element hydrogen it is out there compared to silicium.
So this is a global survey over.
Of in the solar system.
In all solar systems.
So we understand pretty much these elements. We don't understand these elements. There are some problems here that we don't understand either, but I'm not an expert on that.
This is an abundance in the stellar atmosphere of our sun, or I don't understand the graph.
So when you observe the solar system, say that you were to observe the solar system, and you get to have an spectrum of light, then you will see lines missing, or just like when you to spectroscopy. Well, I forgot the word for this, studying the spectrum, the science that studies the spectrum. Point is that you will have some lines missing, and depending on the location in energy of the lines, then you get to know, oh, that was hydrogen, these are the lines of hydrogen, these are the lines of the gold, or the lines of lead, and so on. So just by looking at the spectrum of the stars around the solar system, that the planets, anything that emits some light, okay, then you get to know how much, what is made of, okay? Now, the intensity of those lines will tell you if it's a lot or not. There are some other ways to know about this, and it's what we call the pre-solar grains, or pieces of asteroids that fall into Earth, and then you get to study what is the composition. So getting the information from what is the Earth made of, we're getting what is the asteroids made of, and studying the spectrum of these different objects that emit light, or you can see light of, then we get to know how much is the, what is the solar system made of as a whole.
Any other questions? In your simulation, you get some, you give it in the crust or inside the crust? Yeah.
Okay, let me go back to that and see if I understand the question. This simulation?
Yeah, it's inside the crust. Is it liquid or solid? Is this?
It's inside the crust.
Inside, so it's liquid.
No, it's in the outer part of the crust. So we think of the crust as being crystal, and then the crystals start being smaller and smaller and touching each other, and with some impurities around, and then a transition to the nuclear pasta phase. But this is not for the nuclear pasta. I wanted to tell you, there are simulations of the thermodynamical, the thermal conductivity of the nuclear pasta. I don't remember what is the final result, but it shows that the nuclear pasta is amorphous. Did I mention that? Oh. Sorry, so your question?
So here, there are many different conditions, like the magnetic field,
yes.
Temperature, and also the gravity. You put this as a boundary condition and put it inside the hand, or you make the simulation self-consistent?
So what we can do is to take this for different temperatures. This gamma is the relation between roughly the Coulomb force and the temperature. So we can change it for different temperatures. I show you here only for a set of them. So we can do it for different densities and different temperatures, this simulation. We didn't include magnetic field, okay? Now, magnetic field will be very important because many neutrons that are actually magnetars, okay? So that means that if you are assuming that the thermal conductivity is due to proton-proton scattering or neutron-proton scattering or electron-proton scattering, then that will be affected by the magnetic field, totally. So no, this doesn't include that, and it will be important to do.
But to come back to the question, right? I mean, in simulations when we first did the ensemble being considered for the simulations. So now just talk about temperature. What's the ensemble here? Is it like fixed temperature or fixed
yes,
temperature?
It's a fixed temperature.
Fixed temperature.
Yes, there is an initial composition that is of the crystal, or what we found is a crystallated initial composition of ions that is taken for a nucleosynthesis reaction of imagining, of assuming that the neutron protons are being dragged from another star and being undergoing nuclear reactions with the crust. So there is a final composition to that. That's our initial setup for this simulation. Okay, so that means there is not only one nucleus, there is one that is more abundant, and there are a fluctuation about that, say, charge. Okay?
And also here,
yeah.
So the you have different abundance of the elements. For example, you have oxygen 24. This doesn't exist in our Earth. It just only exists in the neutron star. And after the merger of the two neutron stars, so some material will eject it outside. So what will happen, for example, this exists in this material?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So this results have assumed that the matter, hot matter, comes there. So now there is some out of equilibrium process, right? So it's going to be some burst, right? This energy, because of the hot matter, is going to trigger some thermonuclear reaction. We see an X-ray burst. That's fascinating and so on. Now, oxygen 20, whatever, 8 here is not going to exist if it's not inside the neutron star, right? Now, if you have that, but it's still will exist in the neutron star crust. If you have another star that has a similar composition, then you're going to encounter each other and the matter is going to be decompressed. So gravity, the gravitational energy, is going to be converted in some temperature of the whole system. That increase of the temperature of the whole system dissociates matter, and therefore is going to become neutrons and protons. Okay, so in principle, matter that is ejected in one of these encounters is going to be made of neutrons and protons. I haven't seen a work that hasn't assumed that. It will be interesting to see if you assume, for example, a piece of nuclear pasta being ejected, what kind of material is formed. That I don't think has been studied. So
just after the neutron star merger, people say, oh, we have found where the gold come from the R process of the neutron star ejection. So it's just considered the neutron R-rapid process of the nuclear synthesis. What's the rule of these special elements?
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is the role here. I think I can explain myself with this. So if you were having to have oxygen 26, 27, oxygen will be somehow here in this red line, around this red line, okay? So this is a nuclear charge, neutrons and protons. Actually, the black dot is what we really know that are stable. Everything else is unstable and decays to these black dots, okay? Now, in a neutron star, what is gonna happen is that, for example, there is this in a merger or a of neutron stars, there's going to be some oxygen 28 or any other neutron-rich material that you ion that you find here. Therefore, matter is going to be evolving through this magenta line, and it's going to reproduce these abundances. That is what we're trying to actually compare with the solar abundances. Okay, so the neutron, the oxygen is going to be decompressed. It's going to be torn apart, if you want. And then neutrinos are going to be interacting with these neutrons and protons. If it's not torn apart, then there are going to be a lot of neutrons flying around and being captured by that oxygen 20-something. Okay, it's 28 or whatever it is. But that, because there is no pressure of the other neutrons and pressure of the other matter, is just flying into space, it's decompressed. There is no other nuclear forces that is binding it, like so neutron rich. So it's gonna decay. It's gonna beta decay, and it's gonna become one of oxygen 16. And that decay is what we perceive as energy being hitting at the interstellar medium, and we perceive it as a kilonova. Okay? That's how we get to know that gold was made there, because we can see the line curves.
So this whole process is happening in the ejecta from a star?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are several possibilities. It can happen as the there are tidal effects, right? So there are matter that is going to be initially ejected. It's very neutron rich, and that can undergo nucleosynthesis. But again, because it's ejected with a lot of energy on some velocity out of the gravitational, it can be unbound, okay? So that is gonna undergo nucleosynthesis. But then later, this is merging and then becoming possibly a black hole here. So there is gonna be this disk of matter around it, and there are gonna be neutrinos being emitted, so neutrinos give an extra energy that makes that outflows of that matter in what we call the neutrino-driven wind, and that matter is gonna be neutron-rich. And again, there is nothing that keeps a very dense very neutron-rich nuclei there. It's just gonna be matter that has a lot of energy, neutrons, protons, and that cools down because it's far away from that energy that is happening there, right? Fuses, and then become another R process.
But other than the total energy, the positive kilonova, is there any other, what's your observational test for this whole R process scenario? Do we have any possible observational methods?
For the synthesis of gold?
No, for...
Oh, you mean for...
testing this picture, right?
If there's
another merger, what
no.
The neutrinos, right?
We don't have observations of mergers in gravitational wave.
Electromagnetic energy deposited, that's basically it.
Okay, so what you're asking me is of evidence, observational evidence for the R process.
Yeah.
From supernova, it's just we don't get to process gold. We process in supernova more like silver. Okay, we cannot go as far. We can also have whatever is happening on Earth, right? Like we are a residual of stars after all. So the solar abundances is another evidence for the R process. Right,
and then... No, but I mean in observations of neutron stars, the entire scenario that you picture are painted here, we'd like to have some handle on it, right?
Maybe a question related to this. So I guess one of the big uncertainties in predicting what kind of optical signal you get from like the amount of material undergoing our process is the opacity of that material. I guess there's a lot of uncertainty about what the opacity is for very high density material. Do you think there's any hope for either experimentally or
Okay.
Turn the question around, I guess. Where should the theorists put more work in order to reduce uncertainties so that measurements would actually tell us something?
So there are many things that we can do. Now, theorists, in the nuclear side, the way we think that neutrons are captured by these neutron-rich nuclei depends on the nuclear force again, okay? And that's something that we don't know. There, on top of that, not only about the nuclear force, but the decay modes, okay? So this is a system that a neutron is captured by already neutron-rich nuclei, okay? That amount of energy makes excited states in the nuclei, and therefore there is a cascade after that that is gonna be in gamma rays or maybe particles. So we don't understand that. We have approximate models for that. It works okay if you see what are the comparisons with the solar abundances. We have in the nuclear physics setting some sort of approximation that overall work well, but don't tell us exactly about what is the microphysics that is happening because our approximate models or phenomenological, okay? So work in terms of uncertainties at the nuclear physics level is about the nuclear force, nuclear reactions, that means capture rates. Now, theoretical work in terms of the astrophysical scenario is into figuring out what is the question of state. So after we understand better the nuclear force, try to put that in a statistical model that can be used and adapt for simulation for the question of a state, that include the question.
Yeah, that's more or less the equilibrium configuration. But here you're talking about ejecting things in a very in a violent event, supernova or neutron star merger. And this must be many uncertainties, the nuclear reaction chain, the network, but also the capacities. That, I mean, it's a very complicated problem. So
yes.
I'm trying to understand where should someone put some effort.
Yes.
You may not, I was on with the people trying to do this there. And then,
so I usually explain this like in little boxes. So our uncertainties due to the astrophysical model, uncertainties due to how you process that as observable, as post-processing of simulation. And there is another box that is about the nuclear physics.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So in terms of the astrophysical model,
yeah.
That means how to simulate the neutrino-driven one, how this flies out. Because following a simulation, when you can find out bound bundle, happens, I think there is a room, there is someone talking at 213 this room. I think so. I think I forget the the room is going to be used. But there are ways to try to model this better. For example, including general relativity, magnetic fields, neutrino interactions, because that's very important, right? So this is so many uncertainties.
Okay.
I would love to have more discussions. I just got stressed out that somebody may need the room.
Okay. So let's
thank you very much.